Well, welcome to another Art of Relations podcast. I'm Chris Grace.
And I'm Tim Mielhoff.
And we have a special guest joining us today, Tim, Dr. Brad Wilcox, out of the Director of National Marriage Project, University of Virginia. Brad, welcome to our program.
It's great to be here, guys. Thanks for having me.
Wow, it's good pleasure to have you. And we have just been impressed, Brad, with so much of your work. Real quickly, just for the audience, you're a sociologist trained at Virginia and undergrad and Princeton grad, it sounds like. And then you're now at both a couple of places, University of Virginia, teaching there as a faculty member.
That's right, yep.
And then you direct the National Marriage Project. How did all that start?
Well, there's a guy named David Papineau, who's a sociology professor at Rutgers University. And he started this a number of years ago, probably about 27 years ago, I guess. And he was retiring in 2009 and thought that it'd be great to sort of pass the National Marriage Project from Rutgers to UVA. So that's the quick story.
So you've been doing this now since then?
Since then. And then a few years ago, some colleagues, including Scott Stanley, who you just mentioned at the University of Denver, and I started the Institute for Family Studies, and that's designed to do kind of public education and some research around family questions as well. And I'm also a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, doing work there on the nexus between family and economics. So a couple of different things that all are kind of in your space.
Yeah, no, that's
Chris,
great.
We got to get better guests. We just have to.
Somebody who's got some experience.
No, what drew you to this topic? Like, your grad school, a ton of topics, but what drew you to?
Sure. I was raised by a single mother. And so kind of in college had this sense that, you know, in a more personal way, that dads were important and that became the conclusion that marriage was that institution that kind of connected dads typically to their kids and that I wanted to work around sort of family structure, marriage, fatherhood, you know, and religion as well. Mm. I was raised in a home, Episcopalian home, and you know, had some contact with kind of Christianity at that point and wanted to sort of explore the nexus between religion and family life as well.
That's great. And we're familiar with your research, but not familiar with you. I see you're married.
Yes, I'm married. Yep.
Great. Ask how long?
Sure. We've been married about 23 years now.
Oh, that's great. Nice. So, and how'd you meet?
We actually met at UVA, our April 1st, April Fool's Day, 1992, we met. And there's a story, but no, I mean, it's a good story. Just I had seen my wife, Danielle, around grounds at UVA. We took a class on Nietzsche. That was the first thing. And I sort of noticed her in the Nietzsche class, and then I saw her in the library reading First Things. And I was like, this is kind of wild. She's an attractive blonde. Reading, you know, studying Nietzsche, reading First Things. So we had some mutual friends, and they set us up on a blind date, on so to speak, on that April 1st. And took us about 3 years to kind of figure things out, and then we got engaged and married in 1995.
Right. I met my wife. We were taking a class on Jean-Paul Sartre.
Okay.
No, I'm kidding. I'm just kidding.
I was at a SpongeBob movie, and I saw my wife. So it's kind of been on the other side. So, hey, Brad, one of the interesting things is your journey in this, just as a person and just that idea of parenthood or even children raised without family or without fathers.
Right.
And I just saw a New York Times article that you responded to that kind of pushed back on that a little bit for you. I think it said something like, why are we still pushing against single mothers? It's really difficult. And you responded to that saying, listen, there's a lot of research out there about the role of fathers. And what in general would you like to say about that? And yeah, just your thoughts.
Well, you know, I think it's obviously important to recognize and acknowledge, you know, that many kids raised in, you know, non-intact families and single parent families, whatnot, turn out just fine.
Right.
You know, my sister and I are both doing well now, happily married, couple of kids, but I mean, between the two of us, and gainfully employed, all that kind of stuff. So it's important to acknowledge that, you know, for any given kid, you know, they can do just fine in a variety of family contexts. But I'm also a sociologist, and I will tell you that, you know, on average, kids are more likely to flourish when they're being raised by their own married mother and father. Having that connection to their biological parents, you know, having two people who are really invested in them, who know them from birth, you know, all these things are really helpful for kids. And there's a lot of research, not just kind of on the impact of families or family structure on kids, but even we're sort of finding more and more about how family structure kind of at the community level seems to impact communities. Everything from, you know, crime to what's called economic mobility. That's basically the ability that poor kids can, over the course of their lives, realize the American dream financially. And the American dream is stronger in, for poor kids in communities where there are more two-parent families. And so the point simply is that, you know, is that on average, both kids, men, women, and communities are more likely to be flourishing when you have strong, intact two-parent families in the mix.
There's just some news out, Brad, today that I read. The Prime Minister of New Zealand, she's the third female Prime Minister. Her name is Jacinda Ardern, and she's about to go on leave because she's pregnant. And she's going to be one of the first in history as a head of state to have a baby, and she's not married. Now she's living with the person. It's that kind of thing that you have found in your research that does some damaging things in some respects. Obviously, she could be a wonderful mother and it could be a great family. I really don't know anything about her other than, you know, they love her over there. But this idea of being in a cohabitating relationship and raising a child isn't always the best for a child, whether they're America or New Zealand. I know you've studied different countries and America. What are your, what's your thoughts when you read about that?
Yeah, that's a great example. I did a report with a colleague, Lori DeRose at Georgetown, and some other folks. And we looked at sort of cohabitation and stability for kids in the United States and in Europe. We found is that kids who are born to cohabiting parents were 90% more likely to see their mom and dad break up by the time they turned 12. And we were controlling for a variety of factors, including, you know, parental education, grandma's education, some things that might have, you know, confounded or distorted that relationship. So the point I would make is that, again, in general, you know, marriage is an institution. It's not even a Christian institution in the sense that, I mean, we obviously see marriage in, you know, in Egypt, in India, in China, that different civilizations have used to kind of guide adult relationships and stabilize the connections that parents typically would have with their children. And so when you see a departure from that with cohabitation, for instance, as one good example, like you're mentioning in New Zealand, even though this prime minister may be a great mom and and their family might go the distance, you know, the concern I would have with that situation is that, you know, they're not kind of expressing a commitment to one another in the context of marriage before having a child. And then she's also signaling to her country that this is an okay thing to do. I wrote an op-ed in USA Today about a week and a half ago, kind of calling the Rock here in the U.S. to task.
That was great,
for the same thing. He's having a second child with his girlfriend, Lauren Hashian, outside of wedlock, and that might just go fine for them. But again, he's a very prominent figure here in the States and globally, obviously, as a sort of a major star. And it would be nice if he would actually just put a ring on it and signal his commitment to to Lauren and to kind of their family future together before having, you know, baby number two in this case.
Yeah, I thought that was well written, by the way. Loved it. And I think The Rock is such an influential person, just like, you know, like you, Dr.
Milhoff. I was going to say, he's the second most influential bald man I can think of. But Brad, here's, we get this question a lot. And I think on one level, people are just confused about why cohabitation is so bad. In other words, we were both talking on the way over here that you and I both teach a class on family communication. So I do this thing with my students. I don't tell them ahead of time, but I come in and make an argument for living together. I just sit down and say, how many of you have had a roommate situation that just went really badly? You thought it was going to work out really well. And I actually did my senior year undergrad. I said, so why not live together and give it a trial on many different levels and see each other 24/7 rather than sporadically? And they're all sitting there shaking their heads like, man, that just makes a ton of sense. Sure. And I say, but you know what's funny is research points in the opposite direction. Could you, for our listeners, just unpack a little bit why this is not a good idea for the long-term health of the marriage as well as the long-term health of the kids? You elaborated on just a little bit.
So I have to be honest here. The important thing to note on this big question is that the evidence is much stronger when it comes to kids on this issue than it is when it comes to the adults.
Nice clarification.
Although, again, I would sort of say that from a kind of a community perspective, the whole point of marriage is for the kids. You know, it's not really for the adults. But so what we know is that, again, people who are having kids in a cohabiting union are much more likely to break up than those who are married. And this makes sense, right? Because it doesn't matter if you're in Poland or if you're in Sweden, if you're in Norway, Italy, the United States, Mexico. People see cohabitation as a more flexible arrangement, as entailing less commitment. And this is, you know, something that we've seen in research actually recently, where they're interviewing people across Europe. And obviously differences from these countries in Europe, but they do find across Europe that people sort of see marriage as really the gold standard of commitment. And they see cohabitation as giving people more freedom and flexibility. So for the adults, that can be attractive. But if you're a child and your parents or the two people who are heading up your household are in a more flexible relationship, the flip side of that is not just less commitment, but oftentimes more jealousy, more infidelity, more violence, and much more instability. And if you have had kids, if you cared for kids, if you've babysat kids, you know they thrive on stable routines with stable caregivers. And that's not what cohabitation gives for kids. So that's the kid point I would make quickly. On the adult side, I think the issue there is that, and Scott Stanley at the University of Denver has made this point with Galena Rhodes, his colleague there, is that we're seeing today people are often kind of sliding into cohabiting relationships. There's not a ton of commitment. They're often asymmetrical, where one party is sort of looking at this as a stepping stone to marriage or something serious. The other party's like, this is, hey, this is a way to save on the rent or have access to, you know, good sex on a regular basis. And so the problem, of course, then is that you don't have people on the same page in their relationship. You can have people devoting a lot of time to someone who's not really that committed to them. And then you also can see people kind of just, you know, they get together kind of willy-nilly. They never had serious conversations about their future, their common values. But then they spend a year together. They've got a couch, maybe a puppy together. And then their friends are asking questions. Their parents are asking questions. They kind of just kind of drift into marriage. And those couples are particularly likely to suffer, you know, more conflict, poor communication, more divorce if they go ahead and get married. So the point about cohabitation in adults is that it doesn't seem to really prepare people well for a strong and stable marital future. And in some cases, it can kind of put you together with someone who's not really committed to you and also can kind of take you off the market. So I had a neighbor, for instance, and she was moved in with a guy who's about 3 years younger than she was in her late 20s. And they were together for 5 years. So finally, she's 33. She's ready to get married and have kids. She's kind of pressuring him in a very powerful way. And he's like, you know what? I'm just not ready. You know, I'm just not, I'm not ready for this. And she's like, this is crazy. And so she just broke off the relationship. And she's still single, no kids. And she devoted 5 years of her life to this guy. So again, the point is that the freedom and flexibility that seem attractive, I think, to a lot of younger adults when it comes to cohabitation can have some downsides. So
it's one of the studies we talk about, and maybe you could comment on your a colleague at the University of Virginia, James Cohen. So James Cohen did some work on handholding. He's an amazing expert on, if you can believe that, on handholding. So we talked about him at this podcast. But as a colleague of yours there, he found this whole notion then of about commitment. And the fascinating thing is he put people through this group, just for the listeners, a reminder if they haven't heard this before, that individuals who are about to get shocked anticipated this shock with a lot of stress and anxiety. But when they held the hand of a stranger, their anxiety went down and wasn't as high. And then when they held the hand of the person they were married to, it went down even lower. But the cohabitating partners, their stress level was about indistinguishable from strangers. And I know you know about this study. What do you think about that? I mean, that's commitment. That's cohabitation. That really points to something odd or amazing. I'm not sure if he's in, maybe he's figured it out yet exactly what the variable is, but when people don't make a commitment, it's as if something comes in, stress, trauma, anticipation of pain, and they feel almost like someone doesn't have my back, they haven't made a commitment to me.
Yeah, I think that's kind of a telling example. And here, and he's not a conservative by any stretch, he's just kind of a good scientist doing this work. And again, he found, as you just pointed out, that people derive a lot more comfort in these stressful situations when they're with a spouse rather than a cohabiting partner. And it does signal kind of the fact that marriage really is different. It really does kind of signal to yourself, to your partner, to your family members, your friends, that you're really in it for the long haul. And one way to think about, too, just this difference is to think about kind of the point of entry here. And when we actually ask people about when did your cohabiting relationship begin, oftentimes the two partners will give different dates.
Yes.
Which is fascinating, right? So they don't even have the same, like, they're not even on the same page in terms of when this thing began. Whereas when you get married, you know, you often have
a date.
You know, well, you've got a date.
Yeah.
And usually a ceremony. It might be in a church or, right. Or a synagogue, or it could be at, you know, down at the county court, you know, courthouse. But people kind of know when that happened. Mm-hmm. And usually there are friends and family members there to kind of mark and punctuate the start of your entry into this relationship. So just kind of the more you unpack cohabitation and marriage, the more you realize that they are qualitatively different from one another.
You know, we were in London just last summer, and we were in this incredibly long line for the Churchill War Room. It went on forever, and we didn't know if we were going to make it. And so there was a young couple in front of us, so we just got to talking to this couple. And we told them that we'd been married for, like you, 20-plus years. And I said, are you guys married? And he goes, no, we're dating. And she turned to him and said, no, we're living together. And you could see the tension just a little bit, like, hey, we're not dating. But interesting that they weren't on the same, necessarily the same page verbally, as well as maybe even intellectually, they weren't on the same page. I thought that was really telling. And you could tell it bugged her that he said dating.
Right.
So, yeah.
And one thing, too, there is a gender story here. And again, it's not true for everyone, but we do see, generally speaking, that in a cohabiting relationship, she's much more likely to be committed to a long-term than he is.
Ah.
And in a married relationship, there's still a gap, you know, where she's a bit more committed, but the gap is much smaller in commitment. So, again, the question is, well, whose interests are only being served, at least on a short-term basis, by a cohabitation? And that's an open question.
I think it's important, though, to remind our listeners that not all couples live together for the same reasons. You've been really astute to say that economics plays a role in why couples live together, and that even it's not just financially viable for some couples with the current laws and the current structures for them to get married. They actually get punished a little bit for doing that. Can you unpack, because I don't want everybody to think a couple gets married because they're shirking traditional marriage. They're making a protest statement. I don't think that's true of all couples, but you've noticed that for some couples, this is an economic reason why they don't officially get married.
Yeah, so there's work done by Sharon Sasser at Cornell University on cohabitation, and she finds that working class and poor Americans are more likely to cohabit and move in quickly, in part for financial reasons. Mm-hmm. You know, they're hoping to save on the rent, and they see this as kind of an economically feasible way to do things. And then the related point that gets to your question more directly is that the way that many of our means-tested policies, like Medicaid, for instance, and food stamps, for instance, are structured, is that when you kind of, you know, if you were to apply for them, having gotten married to someone, say you have a baby together, and let's say that the mother is earning about $15,000 a year, and the father is earning, say, you know, $30,000 a year, you know, their joint income could mean that they're not going to qualify for Medicaid, they're not going to qualify for food stamps, or they're going to lose some benefits for when it comes to food stamps. And so when it comes to kind of thinking about healthcare or food, lower income couples, you know, can face a difficult choice.
Right.
And then should we just live together and often have, you know, the mom kind of apply for or get access to one of these benefits? Or do we get married, pool our income officially, and apply, and then maybe lose access? I think particularly when it comes to healthcare, you know, there's real concern, you know, obviously with, particularly with a child in the picture, and also even the cost of paying for the birth, depending upon their situation, you know?
That's
so
anyways,
the point simply is that I think there's a calculus that orients a lot of working class and poor Americans away from marriage.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, there's another calculus for upper middle class parents or upper middle class adults who tend to enjoy better incomes individually and then are thinking about maybe buying a house together and then establishing a 401k down the road.
Yeah.
And so there's sort of the calculus for them economically is actually pushing them towards marriage oftentimes and in ways that just reinforce, you know, the stability of their relationships and their financial advantages as well.
And the point I want people to take away, our listeners, from a communication standpoint, every couple that lives together has a story. And for us to stereotype and to think one thing, it's great to hear their background, their story, why they're doing this, their particular struggles. I think as Christians, we need to be compassionate. I think we need to lead with compassion. So I think that's great, Brad, that there are a bunch of reasons. When we started speaking at marriage conferences roughly 22 years ago, we do this whole session for pre-married couples. Very few were living together. And now we've seen that it is easy. 70% of the people at this session are now living together for a multitude of reasons. So it really is a cultural trend that we're seeing quite a bit.
Yeah. Brad, just in the idea of marriage, I think you called it a marriage premium, marriage benefit. There's another thing you've written about and studied, and that is the benefits of marrying in your mid to late 20s. Real quickly on that one, I know there's a lot of stuff out there on this. What would you say to couples that are considering this? And I mean, that's such a hopeful thing to say. I love that you should be married, and that's a great age to do this. Talk a little bit about that and what you found there.
Sure. Well, there's, I guess, before we get into this, the two important points to make here is that when we look at patterns of divorce, kind of the sweet spot in terms of your lowest risk of divorce is sort of late 20s, early 30s. When we look at marital quality, the sweet spot is sort of the mid-20s, you know. So the point I'm making is that there's a bit of a different story for marital stability versus marital quality. And when it comes to marital quality, I think the advantage of getting married in kind of your mid-20s, kind of broadly defined, is that, you know, you are younger. You have a chance to kind of establish a common life together, to establish traditions, you know, how you handle summer vacation, how you handle Christmas, you know, Thanksgiving, et cetera, with your family. You can kind of think about how you're going to handle work and family, you know, in a more intentional way at a young age. And also for folks who are really interested in having kids, it's a great time to go ahead and have kids. I mean, that's when women are, you know, more fertile, and biologically kind of, primed to have kids. So all these things kind of play into, I think the advantage of having, a wedding in your mid-20s, broadly defined. And we also find, too, that couples who are kind of on the same page religiously are more likely to get married in their mid-20s. Whereas if they wait longer, they're more likely to marry someone outside of their own religious community.
Really? And
maybe it's, you know, they've perhaps moved away to some extent from their religious community, either geographically or otherwise, or, you know, they're less selective in terms of who they end up with, you know, as they get a little bit older. So there are a couple of reasons, I think, why getting married in your mid-20s seems to make sense. And on the divorce point, it's also important to acknowledge that if couples are attending church together and they're getting married in their earlier mid-20s, their divorce risk comes down pretty markedly. So it's kind of a protective factor against the sort of, I think, immaturity that sometimes couples who are getting married in their, particularly guys, who are getting married in their early 20s or mid-20s, you know, will experience.
That role of community is so important. You write about that a lot, that it really does take a village. But that people don't do that. People are more isolated is kind of what you're noticing a little bit today is through a multitude of reasons, we don't form deep roots with other community members and we're paying the price for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely the case. And I think it's, you know, on the one hand, we're hyper-connected with social media.
Yeah.
But it's obviously kind of can be a superficial connection. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, for couples, whether they're young, middle-aged, or older, I think it's great to be involved and connected to some kind of small group where there's a regular sense of accountability, where everyone's able to kind of help one another when someone gets cancer or someone loses a job, whatever else might, you know, or there's a difficult teenager, you know, there's other people to kind of, you know, seek help from. When, you know, when the going gets tough. So I think, yeah, marriages are much stronger when people are embedded in some kind of local community, and a small group would be one good example of that.
But what makes that hard is our frenetic lives. Like we have three boys, all were athletic. And there was one year we just lost our minds. We allowed two of them to be on travel teams. And it was insane. We were separate every weekend. church was something you did when you weren't in the finals of a basketball tournament. And we would sit with people in the stands that we sort of kind of knew each other, but, sure. but these aren't the people that are going to be showing up at your front step if there's an illness or right. checking in on your marriage. Right. So we felt the most disconnected we had ever felt during that crazy season of travel basketball and all that different kind of stuff. So, and by the way, all the parents were in the same boat. We're like, hey, we know that we're crazy busy. This is imbalanced. But community takes effort, and we're going to have to communicate to the kids eventually, hey, I'm sorry, you're not running the show completely. You're just not running the show. So, yeah, interesting that we need that connectiveness. That's a great point.
Brad, this has been just great to talk with you. Here's what I think we ought to do. Let's continue the conversation. Yeah. There are so many topics. Your research, we want to ask a number of questions about what you're doing now, what some exciting findings and things you're doing. So it'd be great to.
I didn't get to my Nietzsche question. I had a Nietzsche question.
Well, let's do that in the next podcast.
You want to
do that?
Loaded. Okay, yeah.
All right, Brad, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for
great work where you're at. And it's just a blessing. I know a lot of people are reading the works that you're putting out, and both of the National Marriage Project and then also AEI and all of the work you're doing there. So thanks for that. And thanks for taking time to be on our show.
It's great to be here, having you.